Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 8th of July, these are our main stories. The United States has confirmed that it will send its cluster bombs for Ukraine's forces to use, to the horror of campaigners. Our correspondent heads to a field of tents being erected in Belarus, possibly for fighters from the Wagner mercenary group. Also in this podcast, the global shipping industry promises to stop contributing to climate change by 2050. And the animal that makes this noise... is back in Angola for the first time in decades. And we begin this podcast with the agreement by the United States to supply cluster munitions to Ukraine. President Biden said the decision was difficult but necessary because Ukraine was running out of ammunition in its war against the Russian invasion. Its military counteroffensive against Russian forces is proving to be slower than Kyiv and its Western allies had anticipated. Both sides are using them on the battlefield. More than 100 countries have banned cluster bombs, which contain large numbers of bomblets and can kill and maim indiscriminately over a wide area. They can lie around unexploded and detonate long after civilians have returned to a former war zone. Children can mistake them for toys. The US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan gave this justification for the decision.
So the bottom line is this. We recognize that cluster munitions create a risk of civilian harm from unexploded ordnance. This is why we've deferred the decision for as long as we could. But there is also a massive risk of civilian harm if Russian troops and tanks roll over Ukrainian positions and take more Ukrainian territory and subjugate more Ukrainian civilians because Ukraine does not have enough artillery. That is intolerable to us.
The Ukrainian MP for Odessa, Alexei Goncharenko, welcomed the American decision.
Ukraine needs ammunition strongly, and cluster ammunition is something which can make a difference on the battlefield. Juridically, Ukraine has all the right to use it because neither we or United States of America are signatories of the convention which forbids using of cluster ammunition. From morally point of view, we have all the right to use it because Russians are using it extensively. Me personally, I was several times under cluster ammunition shelling.
Mr. Biden said he'd discussed the matter with America's allies, but before it was even official, Germany voiced its opposition, as did the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. His objections were voiced by his spokesman Farhan Haq.
The Secretary General supports the Convention on Cluster Munitions, which, as you know, was adopted 15 years ago, and he wants countries to abide by the terms of that convention. And so as a result, of course, he does not want there to be a continued use of cluster munitions on the battlefield.
Our Washington correspondent, Sean Dilley, told me more about this controversial decision.
The US military tends to have large stocks of all munitions. These ones, though, are particularly controversial because, as you say, each cluster bomb contains small individual explosives known as submunitions or bomblets, and they don't all explode when they're dropped. As a result, they've historically injured civilians. More than 100 countries have banned them. Now, the US President Joe Biden, acknowledging the controversy around them, said he's decided to send them anyway after consulting allies because Ukraine is running out of its own ammunition. The Pentagon in the US has not said how many of these bombs may be sent to Ukraine, but it does say the US has hundreds of thousands available.
We heard from Jake Sullivan there. He said US cluster bombs have a much lower dud rate than Russian ones. What was he trying to communicate?
He was addressing concerns about those innocent civilians being injured or killed by unexploded ordnance or UXO in military terms. Now, He was saying in very plain terms that Merrick cluster bombs would have the potential to kill or injure fewer innocent civilians than the Russians, because they say US dud rates is under 2.5% compared with what they claim is 30 to 40% for Russia. Normally, it would be illegal for the US to transfer any of these cluster bombs with a dud rate with more than 1% of the bomblets. But this is something that the President Joe Biden is able to overrule.
The decision, though, does put the US at odds with many of its NATO allies. Germany has sent out very strong signals that it doesn't think this is the right thing to do. Is this a sign of cracks in the Western alliance?
To a degree, Germany has to placate its domestic audience while working in the background on diplomatic channels. Certainly caused concern and consternation among NATO countries. Two-thirds of the 31 members have already banned these munitions. Germany are among those. Now, they're clearly unhappy, but after that top-level diplomacy, it seems they've come round in public at least and say they trust the US to make that right decision. Joe Biden, though, is likely to face questions about this at the NATO summit in Vilnius in Lithuania next week.
Sean Dilley in Washington. Belarus says it's ready to welcome fighters from the Russian mercenary group Wagner, although none of them have arrived yet under a deal that ended their short-lived mutiny 2 weeks ago. A government official in Minsk said the fighters had not yet made up their minds. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg has been taken on a tour of a former Soviet military base about 100 kilometres southeast of Minsk, where hundreds of tents have been erected in recent days, prompting speculation that thousands of Wagner fighters could be housed there.
If Russia's Wagner mercenary group does move to Belarus with its thousands of fighters, where will they live? Today, we were taken to see one possible site. For a small group of journalists, the Belarusian Defense Ministry had organized a tour of an abandoned Soviet military base. Well, of a field in it. A 90-minute drive from Minsk is one of the places where the leader of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, has offered to host Wagner. We were shown row upon row of new tents and bunk beds constructed in the last couple of weeks. The timing, well, that's purely coincidental, claims the military. The brand new tents, it says, weren't meant for Wagner, but for a territorial defence exercise in September. But Wagner can move in if they want to. It's not certain that they do. Unclear, too, the whereabouts of the Wagner chief, Yevgeny Prigozhin. Believed to be still in Russia, he hasn't been seen in public for nearly a fortnight. An aide to the Belarusian defence minister told me that Belarus would have nothing to fear from Wagner relocating here. Private military companies exist in many countries, he says. And that's true. But not all private armies do what Wagner did in Russia, carry out a mutiny and march on the capital.
Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg. Let's talk climate change. Products made all over the world reach their customers via huge container ships. But the shipping industry is one of the world's most polluting. Now, 175 countries have thrashed out a deal to make it more environmentally friendly, but not everyone's happy. Our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath, followed the conference, which ended with a chant from one of the nations most at risk from rising global temperatures.
A delegate from Tonga and the Marshall Islands chants a challenge to climate change at the end of an IMO meeting that might have altered the future direction of the shipping industry. Maritime transport carries around 90% of all the goods we consume, but ships burn carbon-intensive fuels, so their emissions of climate-warming gases are extremely high. The complex nature of the shipping industry means that efforts to curb carbon pollution have, to date, been very limited. So getting unanimous agreement from 175 countries on a longer-term net-zero goal is a major political achievement. Ralph Reginvanu is the climate change minister from Vanuatu.
We have to begin these impact assessments of what different mechanisms are going to result in terms of effects on shipping, effects on climate emissions and so forth. And that needs to happen very, very fast. There needs to be implementation measures that stimulate the change agreed to by next year, then implemented.
However, many observers feel the new deal is not fit for the purpose of limiting climate change. Scientists say the lack of hard targets to cut carbon for 2030 and 2040 mean the plan is already flawed. and there will be little in the way of enforcement or penalties if benchmarks are missed. Dr. Lucy Gilliam is with the campaign group Seas at Risk.
What we've got in this deal is a 20% target by 2030 while striving for 30%. It's kind of got this language in, oh, we're going to try and do it, but the basis is 20%, which is way beyond what's needed.
So how will this new strategy change shipping? It will likely prompt a push for cleaner fuels and might see the addition of sails to some cargo ships as a way of boosting propulsion and cutting carbon. Another element that might speed the transition to greener transport is a proposed carbon levy on ships. Pacific Island delegates want to charge ship owners at least $100 a tonne for the carbon they use. The levy idea is still on the table, and many delegates believe that this, rather than a net zero target, will be the key to bringing down emissions over the decades to come.
Matt McGrath. In Uruguay, the country's worst drought for more than 70 years is in part responsible for its capital, Montevideo, running out of water. The government says there is only a week's worth of water left. The reservoir that serves the city is almost completely empty, and the authorities have turned to the River Plata as a source of tap water. However, its salt and chlorine levels far exceed World Health Organization thresholds, and that's already having an impact on people's health. Professor Mariana Meerhoff from the Department of Ecology and Environmental Management at the University of the Republic in Uruguay spoke to Julian Marshall.
They have been mixing the fresh water that still remains in the reservoir with water from the Rio de la Plata, which is an estuary. So it's a really bad water quality. Therefore, there's a lot of compounds that are risky for health. Everyone that can should not drink or use this water.
How has it come to this, that Montevideo only has a couple of days drinking water left, and that in a country which prides itself on its near universal access to good quality tap water?
Yeah, it's a horrific situation that nobody could foresee. From the academia, we have been warning that the quality is losing dramatically in the past maybe 20 years because of the intensification of production and land use change.
It's not just about drought, you are saying.
No, exactly. It's a combination of 2 years of a normal drought plus the effects of climate change provoking heat waves in the summer and absolute lack of rain that was very hard to predict according to climatologists, plus mistakes in management and absolute lack of long-term planning. So this is the fourth water crisis, and it's by far the worst ever because it's not just water quality, but water quantities.
How are people in Montevideo coping with dwindling water supplies?
Those that are considered vulnerable, they are receiving tap water in bottles or mineral water from private companies, but the state is providing hospitals, schools, and pregnant women in polyclinics in certain neighborhoods and so on. Everyone else is asked to buy their own water, but also these companies that produce drinking water are facing problems because they don't even have water to clean the bottles to give the water they produce from underground. Pharmaceutical companies are closing, food industry, even beer industry, they don't have water to produce food and beer. So they're sending their workers back home. And doctors are saying their instruments are getting bad because of they're getting oxidized when they clean. It's a really huge problem that is cascading into different sectors.
Professor Mariana Meerhoff from the Department of Ecology and Environmental Management at the University of the Republic in Uruguay. Still to come in this podcast.
The Ford Fiesta. Never has more advanced engineering gone into a small car.
With more than 20 million produced worldwide, the Ford Fiesta is ending production after 50 years.
Whether you call it football or soccer in your part of the world, Match of the Day Africa Top 10 is the podcast from the BBC World Service ranking the best African players.
This guy is recognised as the best in the world.
Teams.
Ball coming, turn, boom.
And the biggest moments in African football.
The whole world remembers that.
Remember that, yeah.
It's not just African fans.
Match of the Day Africa Top 10. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
It's called period shaming, the public stigmatisation of women and girls who are menstruating. Now, three people have been arrested at a cheese factory in Kenya after female employees were allegedly forced to strip to check who might be having a period. It happened after a manager at Brown's Food Company tried to find out who had mistakenly thrown a used sanitary towel into the wrong bin. The attempt was unsuccessful. Gloria Owoba is a senator in the Kenyan Parliament. She received several distress calls after the incident. The BBC's Tim Frank spoke to her.
I can't even begin to imagine someone asking me to strip down so that they can see if I'm bleeding and then punish me for having my period because a used sanitary towel was found in a bin. I can't even imagine. I mean, it takes away the dignity. It's wrong on so many levels.
It is, by any definition, awful behaviour if it turns out that this is what happened. There's a bigger question as to whether this is part of a culture which sees period shaming happen. I mean, I don't know how far you think that there is a case for that.
Absolutely. This is just one of the many incidences that are not getting reported when it comes to the period shaming. You know, across the world, we need to get into the space where we are talking about menstrual hygiene management with the seriousness that it deserves. But it speaks to the fact that there's not enough sensitization of menstrual hygiene management, of basic things such as how to properly or where to properly dispose sanitary towels, but also the availability of the infrastructure and the facilities that women and girls need to be able to menstruate with dignity. Kenya is one of the first countries in Africa that has a menstrual hygiene management policy, but you can see that it's not really being embraced with the different industries and organizations. And for me, that is the bigger problem.
Am I right in saying that you too have been caught up in this sort of behavior, this sort of attempted stigmatization?
Oh, yes. I happened to have been period shamed because I accidentally stained my suit on my way to Parliament. And when I made the decision to not go back home and miss a day at my workplace, I got a lot of shaming. There was a lot of, it was horrible. At the time, I will tell you, Tim, that I was completely distraught and it was not a good, I was not in a good place. The public humiliation and all these negative reviews about, you know, don't I know how to manage my period? But now when I look back at the gains that we have made since February 14th, I think that definitely it was a blessing in disguise to many girls and many women across the world. We have managed in Kenya to push the budget up from 260 million Kenya shillings to just under a billion Kenya shillings for provision of free sanitary towels to schoolgirls just because of the highlight of that incident.
Kenyan Senator Gloria Owoba. Now for a sound that hasn't been heard in Angola for decades. No, that's not whale song, but the low hum of giraffes communicating with each other at night. 14 of the long-necked mammals have been transported 1,300 kilometres from central Namibia to an Angolan national park. The Giraffe Conservation Foundation, which organised their move, has hailed it as a huge success for conservation and for giraffes in the wild. Our Africa regional editor, Richard Hamilton, told me more.
They did a 2-year feasibility study because they're quite delicate animals to transport. So they captured them on a private farm in central Namibia. Then they put them on a truck for 36 hours. They said, this is the Conservation Foundation that was involved in transporting them, they said that older giraffes are too risky. So they had deliberately small young giraffes, only about 3 metres high. They put on the truck. They were fully awake during the whole thing. They were not sedated with drugs. And they were given ear tags, which are solar-powered with GPS, so that when they're released, and they've now been released in Angola, they can be monitored and tracked. But before they were released, they were also in a little enclosure for a day or so called a boma, just to get them used to being sort of in Angola before they release them into the wild.
So first time they've been in Angola for 30 years, why did they die out?
So it's not clear, and there's some historical research suggesting they died out as long ago as the 1940s, and they're not sure why. But the most sort of devastation came during Angola's civil war, which lasted from the mid-70s up until 2002. And that had a terrible toll on Angola generally. Up to 800,000 people were killed. 1 million people were internally displaced. The infrastructure was damaged. The economy was in tatters. And the wildlife took an enormous toll as well. So elephants and rhinos were killed. The giraffes were decimated. Some wildlife did survive, such as zebra, cheetahs and leopards. But as I say, there was a huge cost on the wildlife. And then since the end of the war, there's also been poaching and habitat loss as well.
And this project to reintroduce giraffes is part of a wider conservation move, isn't it?
Yes, very much so. And like many countries, Angola, its main export has been oil, and it wants to diversify away from oil. So it sees game parks and tourism as a way to create jobs, fight against poverty. And so this game park, which is called Iona, is part of a large sort of trans-frontier conservation area, which is thought to be up to 50,000 square kilometres. It's one of the biggest in the world. It includes the Skeleton Coast and the Namib Desert in Namibia. So it's part of a wider thing, and they want to reintroduce other species as well, like black rhinos, lions, elephants, birds of prey. Although having said that, elephants are also notoriously tricky to transport across borders.
Richard Hamilton. The Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte has said he will tender the resignation of his entire cabinet after it failed to agree on measures to limit the flow of asylum seekers. Mr. Rutte said the situation was regrettable and that the coalition government carry on in a caretaker role until new elections had been held. Arjan Schippers has the details.
Tensions came to a head this week when Mr. Rutte demanded support for a proposal to limit the scope for families reuniting, in particular the children of war refugees who are already in the Netherlands. This was a step too far for two of the junior partners in the government, effectively ending the coalition. Immigration and asylum policy have been a fraught issue in Dutch politics for years, especially since the rise of far-right parties.
Arjan Schippers. Nickel is an integral part of life, used in stainless steel, mobile phones and electric car batteries. As the world shifts to greener vehicles, it's expected there'll be a huge increase in demand for the metal. But conservationists warn that mining in the world's largest nickel producer, Indonesia, could have a devastating effect on the environment. BBC Indonesia's Valja Balaputri reports from southeast Sulawesi.
The sun has already set on Labengki Island. I'm following a local fisherman called towing into the sea. Spear fishing is easier at night, he says. The fish are sleeping, not swimming as actively as during the day. Tawing is from the Bajau community, an indigenous group famous for their ability to dive and hunt underwater without breathing equipment, even in the dark. To outsiders, they live in paradise, but for how much longer?
Right now, the water is still clear, but in the rainy season, it won't stay that way.
He's afraid of the sea being contaminated by pollution from the open-pit nickel mines that have opened on the other side of the sea. Local says when it rains, sediment is washed from the mines into the sea, burying coral reefs that sustain fish and other marine life. It's a problem that's mirrored across Indonesia, and it's set to get worse. Indonesia, with its vast reserves of nickel, has become a magnet for electric car makers seeking the mineral for its rechargeable batteries. There are now nearly 300 mines across Indonesia, and 90% of the world's refined nickel projects that are being planned are in Indonesia. As the world seeks clean solutions to climate change, traditional communities across Indonesia are under threat. We travel by boat to take a closer look at one of the mines. Green hills are slowly replaced by brown, deforested patches of earth. We dock in a village called Boenaga and are welcomed by reddish-brown water. Lukman is also a Bajau fisherman. He says he can no longer catch fish near his home.
How can we do that with water like that? We couldn't see anything underwater when we dive. We could hit a rock.
A number of mudslides have hit southeast Sulawesi. One of them hit a school and flooded a number of homes last year.
The nickel mining locations are literally in people's backyard. Resident told me that they worry when the rainy season comes, they will face with the same danger of mudslides and flooding.
Individual nickel mining companies near Boyenaga did not respond to our request for comment, but the Indonesian Nickel Miners Association says its member must agree to carry out reforestation or reclamation of the land when they have finished mining an area. In Jakarta, Professor Irwandi Arif, a special advisor to the Indonesian Minister of Energy and Mineral Resources, tells me illegal nickel mining is to blame and is difficult to control.
When it rains, no matter what, the soil will be eroded by water. But legal nickel companies have been advised to have a water treatment system before releasing it into the sea. But for areas outside the legal mines, without a good water management system, the soil will be just eroded.
Novita Indri, a campaigner from Trend Asia, an NGO promoting sustainable development, says regulatory changes are needed.
Indonesia has a lot of homework to do. Strengthening law enforcement, increasing emission standards, and implementing environmental regulation in the mining sectors, among other regulations.
The damage that has already been wrought in Southeast Sulawesi may take generations to reverse. In Labengki Island, for Tawing and other Bajau fishermen, the clock is ticking.
Please, don't let what we most worry about become a reality.
That report by Valjia Balaputri from Indonesia. It's the end of the road for the humble Ford Fiesta, nearly half a century after the first of the small cars rolled off the production line in Dagenham in East London. Since then, more than 20 million have been sold around the world. The last models are being produced in Germany. Claire Runacres reports.
The Ford Fiesta. Never has more advanced engineering gone into a small car.
An instant hit when it was introduced in 1976. The three-door hatchback fuel-efficient supermini was created in the wake of the global fuel crisis a few years earlier. It soon topped the bestseller list, remaining there for decades. 20 million were sold worldwide, 5 million in Britain alone. Seven generations and nearly 50 years on, it all ended in Cologne today. Space in the factory will be given to electric cars instead. Erin Baker from Auto Trader says it's a sign of things to come.
The end of Ford Fiesta paves the way for what is likely to happen across the board as we head towards electrification and the 2030 cutoff, because there isn't much margin in small, cheap cars. Right now, Fiesta isn't viable, and neither will many competitors to Fiesta from other brands.
The Fiesta remains popular in Britain. Just last year, the DVLA said 1.5 million were still licensed. Second-hand car dealers say it'll remain a staple of their forecourts for years to come. Ford recognises it's an end of an era, producing a glossy send-off advert.
Sometimes it went fast. Sometimes it went slow. But it always, always went. Until one day, it didn't anymore.
Claire Runacres. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email, the address globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Holly Palmer and the producer was Marion Strawn. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Hi, Yaya Toure here for a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service, Match of the Day, Africa Top 10. Join me and fellow footballers, Gabriel Zakwani.
Hello.
And Ifan Okuku.
Hi.
As we choose our top 10 from the best of Africa football.
We're not here to play football, but to argue about all things African football.
That's Match of the Day, Africa Top 10. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcast.